I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For a lot of folks, a strong belief in God and advanced scientific research can seem at odds with each other. That's not the case for Catherine Hayhoe. Today we speak with one of the world's leading climate scientists, who also happens to be married to an evangelical pastor. She's built a career out of helping people from all walks of life understand the science behind human-driven climate change and the danger it poses to the globe. Then we'll find out what baseball stats guru Bill James is doing writing a book with his daughter about an axe murderer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. She's an evangelical Christian and a climate scientist, so you wonder how that works. But it turns out that Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, a Texas Tech climatologist, not only can square all of that, she's a leader when it comes to convincing evangelical Christians that climate change is something to be reckoned with. In fact, she and her husband are working on the second edition of a book, A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. She speaks at Westminster College out in Fulton later this week, and she joins us now from the studios of KTTZ in Lubbock, Texas. And Catherine, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why are so many conservative Christians so skeptical about human-driven climate change?
The bottom line is that people we trust are telling us that it isn't real. Climate change has become one of the most politically polarized topics in the entire United States over the past few decades. And today, the number one predictor of whether we think climate is changing and humans are responsible is not how much we know about science, but simply where we fall on the political spectrum.
But there's no question that climate change is real. Am I right about that?
Yes, if we look around the world and, you know, people could say, well, I don't trust those satellites or those thermometers. Toss out the satellites, throw out the thermometers. If we just look at what's happening in our own backyards in terms of when our trees and plants are blooming, what types of animals and insects are there and how they're moving northward the warmer it gets. If we look also at how sea levels are rising and glaciers are melting and our seasons are shifting. All around the world, there are over 26,500. That's 26,500 independent indicators telling us that, yeah, the planet is warming.
You know, you've gained some notoriety in your success at swaying Christian skeptics, Catherine. What's your approach to that kind of conversation?
So often we begin our conversations by loading up all our facts and our data and our scientific reports. But studies have shown that when we start from a position of arguing over, well, you say this, but I say that, all that does is deepen the trench between us. Instead, if we begin conversations by listening to each other, I know that's kind of a novel concept in today's political exchanges, but listening to each other and trying to figure out, well, so what do you really care about? What makes you tick? And then what are you all about that I agree with? I share that belief or I share that value. And you know what? I actually care about climate change because of that value that I have that you do too. And often we can begin a conversation there from a place of agreement, from common ground, rather than from a place of how far apart we are. That conversation can go in a much more constructive direction.
So beginning those conversations with an argument, with lots of contention, you're saying that doesn't work.
No, it just deepens the trench and often solidifies both people's positions. It drives us further apart rather than bringing us together.
You know, it's going to surprise a lot of people out there that one of the world's leading climate scientists is an evangelical Christian. How do you reconcile your faith with your belief and your work in evidence-based scientific research?
I'm sad that it is a surprise because I don't view them as in conflict at all. And in fact, I know many other scientists who share my beliefs, who are Christians of all different types and natures. The reality is that if we look at faith, as the book of Hebrews tells us, is the evidence of what's not seen. What is science other than the evidence of what is seen? Mm-hmm. They're two halves of the same coin. Science tells us what and where and how, and faith tells us why.
And do your friends at your church, you're married to an evangelical pastor, I should point out.
I am.
Do your friends, do they struggle with where you come down on this?
Originally, I think probably some of them do, but through just getting to know each other and getting to understand that we share so many of the core values, what really makes us tick is not our opinion on climate change, but our shared faith, our belief in God. Starting from that area of common ground, we can build trust in each other and then again move forward to the point where now, I think almost every Sunday when I go to church in our conservative evangelical church in West Texas, just about every single Sunday, a different person comes up to me in church and just, you know, pats my shoulder and says, I think what you're doing is great. Keep it up.
No kidding.
Yeah.
In a TED Talk I watched online, you showed a graphic that showed, I thought it was really convincing, that showed the Earth over the years and how it's warming. I mean, again, that struck me as pretty darn convincing. Describe it to us. Yeah.
The fascinating thing is that we don't have to agree that the world is any more than 6,000 years old to agree that climate is changing dramatically. In fact, I would go even further. I would say we don't have to agree the world is any more than 300 years old to agree that humans are changing climate. And everybody agrees on that as far as I know. So often we kind of get hung up in saying, well, you know, the ice core data, and we do have ice core data going back hundreds of thousands of years showing these repeating, you know, cold and warm cycles. We're currently at the top of a warm cycle, and instead of heading into the next cold cycle as we should be naturally, we are heading up in the other direction. Often we get hung up on this, whereas the reality is, to understand what's happening to our planet, all we have to do is go back to the beginning of the industrial era, which is when we started to dig up massive amounts of coal and gas and oil and burn them, producing carbon dioxide, which is wrapping an extra blanket around our planet. And just like an extra blanket traps our body heat at night, keeping us warmer than we would be otherwise, so too this extra blanket is trapping too much of the Earth's heat, and that's why the Earth is running a fever.
Now, you mentioned that some folks come up to you after church and they pat you on the shoulder and they tell you how much they appreciate what you do. Do you have members of your congregation who still look at you skeptically and wonder what it is that you are doing and if it makes any sense?
There is certainly a few, but when we first started, there was a lot. In fact, I would say the vast majority were of that perspective when the new pastor showed up with a wife that people weren't quite sure what to make of. But what happened was a lot of people started asking my husband all of their questions, because many more people are doubtful or curious than are really, truly 100% dismissive of this issue. So my husband started to get so many good questions. How do we know this isn't a natural cycle? If God's in control, then doesn't that mean it'll all work out fine in the end? You know, if the world's going to end anyways, why do we care? He started to get all these questions, and we were looking around for resources to give people, and we couldn't find a good resource that started where people were at. So that is why we wrote this book together, A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. And it's also why last year we started a new PBS digital series, which you can find on YouTube, called Global Weirding. They're these short 5 or 6 minute videos that answer these questions, like, what does the Bible say about climate change, if anything? How do we know it isn't just a natural cycle? Isn't this climate change some new thing they just thought up recently? What about all this crazy weather we're having? What does that have to do with it?
What does the Bible say about climate change?
Well, short answer is nothing. There is no occurrence of climate and change or global and warming.
I was going to say, but I wasn't aware there was anything in the Bible about that, so I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah.
There absolutely isn't. But as with so many other modern day issues, the Bible has a great deal to say about our attitudes, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So from the very beginning, in the first chapter of Genesis, where it talks about how we have responsibility over every living thing on this planet, and some translations use the word dominion, but even still, if you have dominion over a company and you run that company into the ground, nobody really respects you for that. They want you to be responsible, to help the company grow, to, you know, help the employees have good lives. So from Genesis, where it says, you know, responsibility for every living thing, throughout the Old Testament, where it talks about God's joy in creation, in nature, then throughout the New Testament, where it talks very extensively about our attitudes and perspectives towards people who are suffering and how we're to love and care for the poor and the widows and the weak and the children and the homeless of this world, the very ones who are being disproportionately impacted by a changing climate today. And then you get all the way to the end, the book of Revelation, where it says, and God will destroy those who destroy the earth. So throughout the whole arc of the Bible, there's no verse that says climate change or global warming, but there's plenty of verses that have a lot to say about our attitudes and our actions.
Catherine Hayhoe is my guest. She's an evangelical Christian and also a leading climate scientist. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. The other question you said you've been asked from time to time, you know, was if the earth is going to change anyway, why should we care about climate change? How do you respond to that one?
I don't respond with the science to that one. I go again to the Bible because that's often where it's coming from. And in the book of Thessalonians, there were people there who were saying, well, the world's going to end any day, so I'm just going to quit my job, lay around, eat, drink, and be merry, so to speak.
Right.
And the Apostle Paul wrote to those people, and he said, no. He said, get a job, support your family, care for the widows and the orphans and the poor, because that is what we are here to do. We are here to be God's hands and feet, to express God's love to the world at this time.
How do we know that this round of global warming is due to human activity? Because we have an email here, I'm going to read you in a minute, who expressed doubt about the fact that humans are the primary drivers of climate change. What about that?
So our most recent Global Weirding video, which you can find on YouTube, globalweirdingseries.com, our most recent Global Weirding video is, it's just a natural cycle, isn't it? This is the most frequently asked question, because if we look at the history of the Earth, it is obvious that there have been warmer and cooler periods in the past. So when we see things changing today, the first thing we have to do, if we're going to be responsible, is not say, oh, it's got to be humans. No. We have to say, could it be a natural cycle? Could it be the sun? Could it be volcanoes? Could it be the reasons why climate has changed in the past? And to really get into those, you'll have to watch the video. But in a nutshell, the answer is, when we look at the sun and natural cycles and volcanoes and where we are in the ice age cycles today, our Earth should currently be gradually, slowly cooling. But it isn't. It is moving in the opposite direction. And the only possible reason that it could be warming instead of cooling is the fact that when we burn coal and gas and oil, we're producing heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket around the planet, trapping that heat inside. So people say, well, how much of the warming is human? And the answer to that is kind of hard to wrap your head around. The answer to that is more than 100%. And people say, well, how can more than 100%? It's because we should be cooling and we're not. So not only are we warming, and that's all human, but that warming is actually even offsetting some of the cooling that would be naturally happening.
So it has to be human cause, is your point.
There's no other explanation, and we have been kicking the tires of alternate explanations for over 150 years. That's how long we've known about this. Just 2 years ago, a group of colleagues and mine, we said, well, we recognize that people are still proposing alternate reasons why the world could be warming, so we're going to round up all of the latest studies that were published on this that we can find, and we rounded up 38 studies. Now, on the other hand, in that time those 38 studies were published, hundreds, even thousands of studies were published, you know, showing that it is humans. But we rounded up 38 we could find saying, no, it's something else. It's some unknown natural cycle, or it's cosmic rays, or it's something else causing us to warm. And we analyzed those 38 papers, reanalyzed from scratch everything that they did. And in every single paper, we found an error. Sometimes a methodological error, sometimes an error of assumption, sometimes incorrect representation of the physics. In every single one, we found an error that, if corrected, would bring their results in line with what we've been finding in 150 years worth of scientific research. And I have a little post on that, plus a link to that study on my Facebook page if anybody's interested in following up. So to me, that's very convincing that when you kick the tires, and we kick the tires all the time, every single time we can't find anybody who has evidence that it's anything else.
How global warming squares with evangelical Christian thinking is our topic here today. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Bryce from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Now I'm staying online for lunch, so I hope you can hear me. But I just wanted to call in and comment that this point of view is completely refreshing, because I'm a Christian myself, but sometimes, and even in church, I see somehow, you know, science and God being separated. And not too often we hear that the two do work together, which is what I believe in as well. So I think over the course of time, there's been so many things, whether it be global warming or, you know, obviously people issues, they've become conservative, evangelical points of view, but really, in reality, it all goes together. So I'm happy that you have this guest.
Great.
And I appreciate all that you're doing, because it's something that we all need to hear, for sure.
Bryce, I'm glad to have your call. Thanks very much. I should point out that Dr. Catherine Hayhoe will speak this week at Westminster College's 2017 Hancock Symposium. She'll be talking about what it is that keeps Americans divided on the issue of climate change. More information is on the Westminster College website. You know, Catherine, people are funny about climate change. You point out that you put a group of people in a warm room, for instance, and most of them will wind up agreeing that something's going on with the planet, and put them in a cool room and maybe they think otherwise. What do you make of that?
We are controlled by our subconscious a lot more than we think. Often we have these opinions, these strong opinions, but we don't often back up to think, well, why do we have them? Where did they come from? The reality is, I love Bryce's call, because the reality is if we believe that God created this amazing universe that we live in, then what is science other than trying to figure out what God was thinking when he set the whole thing up to begin with?
Oh, that's interesting.
The idea that science and faith are incompatible, I think, is a dangerous one, because as we know, many young people today are leaving the church, and people have been scratching their heads saying, why are so many young people leaving? Well, Philip Yancey, a well-known Christian author, offers a perspective on that, and he said when he got to university, he felt betrayed by what he had learned in his church. Now, he's still a Christian author, but he said he had been told all kinds of things growing up in his church, including, you know, the superiority of the white race of all things, as well as other things related to science. And when he got to university and learned that this was not true, he felt absolutely betrayed by the people he trusted. And so we have many people coming to university realizing that, yes, the planet is warming. God's creation tells us it is. God also says that we have choices, and our choices have consequences. And climate change is a consequence of choices that we are free to make. And then we feel like, well, but, you know, the people we trust told us otherwise. And it's one of the reasons, I think, that for a lack of authenticity that can potentially drive people away, not necessarily from Christ, but from the church.
You know, in that same TED Talk that you gave, you talked about how on a snowy day when you're wiping the sleet off your own windshield, the thought that global warming is a bunch of hooey sometimes even creeps through your mind. That's amazing.
Yes. I know. We all, the number one thing that I hear between November and March is,
yes,
it is cold outside. Where is global warming now?
Yeah, exactly. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. When you speak at Westminster this week, you're going to offer suggestions for shifting the focus toward climate action based on Americans' shared values and concerns. What does that mean exactly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm speaking on Wednesday morning at, I think, 9:45. People are welcome to come or check out what we have available online. A lot of my talks are on my YouTube channel. And what I'm going to be talking about is if we really believe who we are as Christians, we're created in God's image to be stewards of this planet and to love and care for others, especially the poor and the vulnerable, as God loved us. If we believe that's what the Bible says, which it does, then I think we should be at the front of the line demanding action on climate to help people who are already suffering today from poverty, hunger, disease, lack of access to clean water. All of these things are being exacerbated by a changing climate. That's why we care. It's not about the polar bears. It's about people.
I wonder if you had a chance, to speak to President Trump, what you would say to him.
Well, again, I wouldn't show up with a cartload of scientific reports and facts and figures. What I would do is I would try to figure out, well, what motivates him? What makes him tick? What is something that a value or a concern that he has that would synchronize with this issue of a changing climate? And so perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps I would say to him, you have a choice right now. The world is facing one of the greatest crises it has faced in the history of our civilization today. Climate change is a concern because it affects us, humans. You have a choice. Will you be Nero, who fiddled while Rome burned, or will you be the hero who saves the world?
Let's go to Greg from Lawrence. Greg, you're on Up to Date with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, if you believe in climate action, what do you think of Trump's position withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accords and his appointment of someone to the EPA who has opened up the fracking and other actions which seem to contribute to global warming?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. What about that, Catherine?
That's a great question. We live in an era where we are hearing people speak as if science is a matter of opinion, as if I can say I don't believe in gravity and then I step off the cliff and I won't go down. But the reality is that no matter whether we think we believe in it or not, science isn't something you believe in. And that's another key difference between faith and science. Science is something that is. And so we can say the world isn't warming, humans aren't responsible, it would ruin the economy to do something about it, even though there's far more jobs in the solar energy industry today than the coal industry. We can say all these things, but if we act contrary to the way the world actually is, it's not just frustrating, it's actually dangerous. Because we are moving in a direction not based on fact and reality and information, but based on a false perception of how the world is. And so with the Paris Agreement, I was actually honored to be in Paris when that was signed. I was there meeting with the head of the World Evangelical Alliance, Bishop Ephraim Tendero, who is actually a representative for his country, the Philippines. I was there with other evangelicals from around the world. Every country in the world was there. There's only three countries that do not want to participate in the Paris Agreement. One is Syria, because they literally could not get anybody to Paris because of the political instability and the crises in their country. One is Nigeria, because they think the Paris Agreement is too weak and they want to do more. And then there is the United States, saying, we've produced over a third of the heat-trapping gases responsible for this problem over the past century. But we're just going to fold our hands and step aside and say, no, you deal with it. We know that the poorest and most vulnerable countries in the world that have done nothing to contribute to this problem are the ones who are already suffering the majority of the impacts. But we're just going to step aside. We're going to let China take over economic leadership in the new clean energy economy. We're going to let India, which is also rapidly advancing, we're going to let them set records for the cheapest solar energy on record. The United States is not only making decisions based on incorrect information, but they're actually ceding technological and economic leadership to emerging economies who are all too eager to take it.
Is our position immoral in your view?
That's a tough question. I mean, as a Christian, I can only speak to myself. And for myself, I believe, for me, if I made a decision that deliberately ignored the very real suffering that I have personally witnessed in favor of my own short-term economic gain, I think that would be wrong for myself.
We have an email here from Gabby who asks, what does your guest say to those who see climate change as biblical and a sign of end times?
Ooh, I just heard that one the other day. So I grew up in the 70s, and my parents had a bookshelf full of, you know, Hal Lindsey and the end of the world and the signs of the times. My husband remembers one time going to youth group when the youth group minister said, you know, this is the last day on earth. And his mother pulled him aside. She said, no, it isn't. You can just go anyways. So we grew up in this culture that was very much looking to the end. But I would, again, take those people back to the book of Thessalonians, where people at that time thought that the end was imminent, as, you know, as it could have been. And rather than saying, okay, well, we have to double down and really make sure we're doing what we're here to do, they just kind of quit their jobs, folded their arms, sat back and said, well, the world's going to end anyways. And the Apostle Paul said, no, that is not the way we are called to live. We are salt and light in the world. We are called to express God's love to other people. Even if the world is going to end tomorrow, there is still something we could be doing to help people today.
Catherine Hayhoe speaks this week at Westminster College's 2017 Hancock Symposium. More information on the Westminster website. Her new book with her husband, A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. Catherine, what a pleasure to have you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much. And if anybody wants more, check out our Global Weirding videos on YouTube.
Okay. Thanks again. Time for a break. When we come back, baseball stats legend Bill James will be here to talk about how he thinks he solved a 100-year-old serial killer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, we learned about the environmental impact of climate change on polar bears. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we meet a former civil rights activist who's taking the fight for change to neighborhoods. Also, we look at the response to a journalist's article defending Kansas City Chiefs player Marcus Peters' national anthem protest. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, most people know that baseball man Bill James is a renowned researcher whose baseball abstracts champion the use of stats to shed new light on the game. Now, Bill James, along with his daughter Rachel McCarthy James, has trained his considerable skills in a new direction, which is solving a more than century-old series of crimes that shocked the nation. The weapon used, an axe, the manner of death, the blunt side of those axes used while the victims slept. Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James chronicle all this in their new book, out tomorrow, The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery. Bill James is a senior advisor of baseball operations for the Boston Red Sox. He lives in Lawrence. And Bill, what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Rachel McCarthy James studied creative writing at Howland University. She also lives in Lawrence. And Rachel, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, Bill, this book is going to confuse people who think of you strictly in baseball terms. What got into you?
I got interested in, this is my second book about crime.
Yes.
I got interested in the series that surrounds Villisca about 7 years ago, thinking I could write a book about it in a year, and it just grew and grew and grew, and eventually it became a very gruesome story.
You know, Rachel, how did you guys come across these century-old crimes? What got them on your radar screen?
Well, Dad hired me as a research assistant in November 2012. He had sent me one of the crimes that he had found in Hurley, Virginia. I was living in Roanoke, Virginia at the time, and it was not very far away. So he sent it to me thinking I'd be interested. I kind of skimmed it and forgot about it. And then later, he hired me to start looking for more cases of this type that he had come across. He knew that there was more to the killer's crimes than just Valeska. He'd found about 8 or so associated crimes, and he said, I need you to figure out if these are all there is or if there's more. So he told me to start looking through newspaper archives for crimes of the same description. And within a couple of months, I had found about 10 more crimes. And in about another month after that, I found what we believe to be the first of his series of crimes.
Wow. We're talking about the original crime being in Villisca, Iowa. Bill, maybe it's a good time for us to get that crime on the maps of our listeners here. It was a horrendous crime, a mass murder in a little farmhouse up there. Tell us what happened.
You said that's the original crime. It's actually very near the end of the series.
It's the first one in 1898.
It's the original crime in the sense of where our interest was.
Yes, there you go.
8 people were found murdered with an axe inside a locked house with the blinds all drawn in a small, quiet Midwestern town. The remarkable thing about it is it's probably not the most people he killed in one incident. Although it's a very famous crime, there's another crime which is totally obscure, which seems to be the same guy, in which 9 people were murdered.
And that one, the case just completely disappeared from newspapers after about a week.
Yeah.
A lot of these were just completely forgotten by most people, except for some people in the area who had special knowledge of local history.
What made the two of you even think that what happened in Villisca might have been replicated elsewhere across the country? What even got you thinking that way?
Well, we weren't the first to know that. At the time, in 1912, people were aware that there was somebody riding the rails, killing families across the nation. But after World War I and other famous crimes it just kind of faded from popular consciousness. But then a woman named Beth Klingensmith in 2006 wrote this excellent research paper that connected several of these events dating from in 1911 and 1912. Then Dad thought, oh, I wonder if there's more to these crimes, and he found one in 1909. And at that point, he thought, let's see how many more we can find. And
Bill, as you went along and began discovering these things, there was one after another after another. I mean, that must have been quite a sense of discovery for you, sitting, what, in your house on the internet, or how were you doing it? Yeah.
Well, when I discovered crimes in old newspapers, my first thought was this could be related, and then you reach a point of maybe this really is related, and it takes a long process. Rachel found a string of about 20 crimes in no time, and my initial thought was, I'll look at them, 99% of them won't be related. You can't get 99% of 20, but let's skip that. It's actually
spoken like a true statistician, Bill. Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
And I actually studied about. I went through and looked at murders of family murders, basically from 1890 to 1920, just to make sure that I got them all. I looked at about 250 crimes of that description between this time period. About 50 of them or so, well, maybe more like 35 of them we cover in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, I was going through and trying to look at what was a mother killing their children versus what is somebody coming in the middle of the night and nobody knows who did it and it was done with an axe, and trying to figure out what are the characteristics of this murderer versus just random events.
I mean, these were particularly gruesome murders, Bill. And this isn't your random shooting. This is really nasty stuff.
After almost, that's one of the things that triggers our interest in a crime is the newspapers describe it as the most horrible crime in this part of Kansas or the most horrible crime in this part of Missouri. Then that's a trigger that it could be our guy. The challenge of writing the book was to avoid getting too dark, because the underlying subject matter is very dark. And one struggles throughout in writing the book to try to avoid getting sucked into a sort of evil vortex.
Mm-hmm.
And
how'd you do that?
One thing, there are a lot of things that happen that are related to the story but are not merely a repeating of telling the story. But another is to create a picture of the lives that these people lived rather than merely their deaths. And to the extent that I could, we tried to give you an understanding of the time and the places where the crimes occurred rather than focusing on the horrific details of murders and lynchings that followed the murders.
It's as much about small towns and at the turn of the century,
yes,
as it is about murders. At some points, we just start saying, you know what happens after this, because we've described it so many times at this point.
Mm-hmm. Hey, how did Villisca, what was the reaction in that town of this family of, I think, six, with two neighbor girls spending the evening, I think, with their friends? What kind of repercussions did this have in little Villisca, Iowa, which is it's in the southwestern quadrant of the state.
Tiny little town, yeah.
Unprecedented. And that's one of the things that makes what happened in Villisca after the crimes is something that has never happened, to the best of my knowledge, in any other town ever. The town fell into a terrible, destructive battle over who had committed the crime, which divided the town so bitterly that it took generations for most of that to go away. It's unprecedented. It's never happened anywhere else.
But you found it elsewhere, that people who were innocent of these crimes, apparently innocent, were jailed, they were lynched, they were, all kinds of horrible things, Rachel.
Part of his body count, basically, was not just the people that he personally killed, but the people who were falsely accused and then murdered through judicial or extrajudicial means. There's Howard Little in Hurley. Paul Reed and Will Cato were two men lynched in South Carolina, I believe. It's just a really horrible... You think one of the chapters is called Just When You Think the Story Couldn't Get Any Uglier, because you've got all of these crimes and then you've got these horrible towns tearing each other apart and killing innocent people because of the damage that he wrecked.
Yeah. What was amazing to me, too, is you're talking about the times in which these crimes were committed, this notion that the FBI didn't exist then and a national crime-fighting operation wasn't in place, to begin to look at this and say, hey, there might be connections all up and down the rail lines here.
Well, people didn't know what serial killers were. There was no conception of a serial killer existing, whereas right now everyone is very aware of what a serial killer is and is interested by these mysteries and is very aware of the fact that someone can randomly kill you with no motive and no explanation. At the time, that just didn't happen. If someone was murdered, it was someone that someone was sleeping with or someone who had a business grudge against them. There was usually, it was thought to be something that could be figured out pretty quickly. And one thing that was interesting to me about the writing of this book was how quickly the justice system moved. Here, if you've got a murder trial in 2017, it lasts a year minimum, usually more like 2 years.
Yeah.
Here, we've got people who were murdered on Christmas Day and someone was killed, executed for that crime by St. Patrick's Day. So it was just a very swift move to justice because these crimes were so horrible that they were inexplicable to the people in the whom it affected beyond the victims themselves.
A swift move to justice that was too swift.
Yes, exactly. Less than a week sometimes.
Yeah. Actually, a swift move to injustice.
Yeah.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here at Up to Date. If you want to join our conversation here about this new book, The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery from Bill James and his daughter, Rachel McCarthy James. I should point out, too, that the two of them will be talking about their book at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More information, rainydaybooks.com. That's 6:30 on Thursday evening. Okay, I've got to ask, Bill, usually you work by yourself, you're working with your daughter. How did that work for you? That can be tricky.
It can be tricky. I've co-authored books before and found that to be stressful and promised never to do that again. But this worked better in part because we know each other really well, and I already knew all of her faults.
I inherited a lot of them from him, to be frank.
Hey, your mother gets partial credit for this.
The fact that your research was done, what, online? Is that where you found a lot
mostly,
of this stuff?
Mostly, almost all online.
Was amazed that so many records, so many pages from small-town newspapers are available today online. I know everything is, but small town papers?
That's the only way we were able to get this done. That's the only way we were able to make this connection was that we went on this newspaper archive service, newspaperarchive.com, which is very expensive and very difficult to use, but it's got this huge breadth and depth of papers that allowed me to basically search for the key terms family, murder, sometimes fire, and figure out and find these little events in little towns and make record of them and sift through them, basically. So, yeah, it was an incredible, couldn't do this without the internet, basically.
You know, Bill James, what was remarkable to me about these crimes was the similarity between them. We've already talked about the use of an axe. And this would be an axe, what, that was found at near the household?
Normally, yeah. In this time period, most houses were heated by burning wood, and the murderer would find an axe in the backyard and break into the house. There are actually 33 things that we listed that identify our crime. And, of course, they're not all 33 found but there are 33 different things that show up.
One of them, their faces were covered, the victim's faces were covered by a cloth.
Right, and he murdered a family in Paola. And in the Paola murders, the police chief, the local police immediately recognized, oh, this guy's done this before, because he put the blankets over their head before the attack so that he wouldn't be hit by flying blood. And that would, you know, it's not something you would do if you... And that's the only place in the entire series where the local police chief was sharp enough to pick that up immediately.
So he would put the cloth over them before he killed them.
Yes.
Wouldn't you think they'd be waking up at that point?
Well, it's very quick. It's a quarter of a second. You know, first of all, he really knew what he was doing, and we have to assume that he attacked people so rapidly that they could not wake up.
That's really interesting. Well, at some point, how many victims altogether?
Roughly 100.
100?
Roughly 100. We're not sure. And part of this book is talking about, well, this crime might be part of the series, but it might not for these reasons, or this crime is definitely part of the series for X, Y, and Z reasons. But we believe it's around 100, and about, we were debating this on the way over, about 25 families.
And at any point, did anyone in those days begin to think of the phrase serial killer? Did that ever come up?
No, they were calling him Billy the Axeman, I think.
Yeah.
So they did have a name for him, and they knew it was going on, but they didn't. Serial killer was just not a thing then.
But if I could weigh in, in there, people did connect the dots. He murdered a family in Ellsworth, Kansas. On the day that crime happened, the newspapers immediately reported this is the fiend from Colorado Springs, where he had committed this previous crime. So they were connected in that sense, but they couldn't take that short walk from random crimes to truly random. And when they realized that he'd been in Colorado Springs and in Ellsworth, they began immediately looking for someone who hated the family murdered in Ellsworth and also hated the families murdered in Colorado Springs. There wasn't any such person, of course, so they sort of knew it was random, but they couldn't quite get there in terms of it's truly random.
Well, but the train tracks, you think, would be a pretty clear clue.
But there were so many more train tracks back in the day.
Okay.
I mean, it was much, America in 1912 was much more reliant on train travel than it is today. So,
you know, Bill, at some point in the course of working on this book, you got the idea that maybe you could even come close to solving this thing. What made you think you could solve a crime that occurred more than 100 years ago?
Well, no, I didn't think. I mean, it's a happy accident, and Rachel gets most of the credit for that. It's a happy accident. What happened is I said, if you walk in this direction in your research, you may stumble across the perpetrator. And she walked in that direction, and she did find him. But it's luck. I mean, you can take another crime series. Luck and hard work. But I didn't honestly expect to find it.
What he said to me at the beginning of when he told me about what he wanted me to do is he said, at some point you're going to come across a crime that looks similar to the rest of these crimes, looks similar to Valeska, et cetera, but has one key difference. And there was a key difference in the first crime that we were able to find that we talk about at the end of our book, which I'm not going to spoil.
I was
going to
say, do you want to talk about the culprit here, or do you want to save that for the readers?
Let's let the readers. I'd prefer to save it for the readers.
Yeah, okay. The man from the train was never caught. Did authorities ever come close?
The closest they came was, I would say, in the first crime.
Right. In the first crime, they probably were close. There's another crime where we believe that he was injured in the process of the crime, and there's a blood trail leading away, and they may have been close in that case. But toward the end of his series, they weren't within 100 miles of him. They had no idea.
He was very well practiced at that point. Yeah. He knew exactly what he was doing.
How different was America back in those days, Rachel?
Oh, well, honestly, that's Dad's area of expertise.
Hey, I'm not that old.
Born 1908, right?
1900, 1910 is a period of enormously rapid change. I'm a historian of crime. I know a lot about old crimes, but I had no understanding when I started this of how disorganized the criminal justice system was in 1910. One of the things I didn't understand is that private detectives were the chief resource, not what they are now at all. When a crime occurred in a small town like Paola or Ellsworth, the first thing they did was to call private detectives. And the area would be flooded by private detectives, a third of whom are con men and a third of whom are just nuts,
mm-hmm.
who would rush in, some trying to solve the crime. And some of them were, you know, the Miss Marple isn't that different. I mean, I always thought this is just an absurd fictionalization invented by Agatha Christie and others, but it isn't. There were actually people like that who got involved in murder.
Yeah.
One thing that I thought was interesting and similar was you'd have these cases where people were basically crowdfunding for a private detective to solve the crime. They'd get together and put together $500 or sometimes $2,000, which was a huge sum in the day, to try and hire a private detective to find the crime, and they never did. But one thing that Dad talked about in the book was how big the changes were technologically. In 1898, when this started, very few houses had electricity. By 1912, you were starting to see that. Same with phone lines, cars. These early technological things were starting to show up more and more in this short time period.
Yeah, I was struck, but I wanted to ask you just quickly, in the minute we have left here, you came out, you mentioned what this wasn't your first crime book, that you came out in 2011 with another book, Popular Crime, and in it you offered a series of theories on a host of well-known crimes, including two I wanted to ask you about. Let's start with JonBenet Ramsey, the six-year-old girl killed in her family's Boulder, Colorado home in 1996. You say her parents are innocent in her death, which runs counter to the conventional wisdom in that case. How did you come down on that?
Well, first of all, if they committed the crime, it would be a crime without any parallel in the history of the world. There's never in the history of the world been a crime in which parents like this committed a crime like that one. So that makes me skeptical.
Right.
But I think what it was unconventional at the time, but I think almost everybody involved in the research in that case now has realized that that has to be the case, that there's just no evidence that it's them and it's not them.
And President Kennedy, his assassination, you have a theory about that one too.
Well, it's not my theory. It's a theory developed by Howard Donahue in Baltimore and popularized by Mona Menninger, who's a member of the Menninger family. The theory is that while Oswald did all of the things that he's alleged to have done, the fatal bullet actually is an accidental misfire from a Secret Service agent. Mm. It sounds improbable at first blush, but when you really study the evidence, it never breaks down. You never reach the point at which you say, no, that can't be true.
Huh. Bill James, Rachel McCarthy James, the new book, The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery. It comes out tomorrow. Thank you both. What a good conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good luck with the book, guys. Again, you can see and hear them Thursday evening at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Library. Tomorrow, we'll look at transforming struggling neighborhoods and the troubling responses to a journalist's defense of Kansas City Chief Marcus Peters' national anthem protest. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produce our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.